Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 30th, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call. Welcome to a special Practice Group's Teleforum conference call. Today, our Teleforum conference call will cover two U.S. Supreme Court decisions, the Hobby Lobby and the McCullen versus Coakley cases. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today four experts for our call, which will go as long as 90 minutes. That's a special extended time for our call today, 90 minutes. We're going to have opening remarks from each of our callers, each of our experts, of about 5 minutes. First, on the Hobby Lobby case, we'll go through each of the speakers on Hobby Lobby for 5 minutes each. Then we'll have some discussion among them. Then we're going to go through another round with our experts on the Coakley case, some more discussion, and then ultimately we'll be turning to the audience for questions on either or even both of the cases. For our first round, we will hear first from Professor Michael P. Moreland. He's Vice Dean and Professor of Law at Villanova University School of Law. He'll be followed in his opening remarks by Professor Richard W. Garnett IV. He's Professor of Law and Concurrent Professor of Political Science and Founding Director of the Program on Church, State, and Society at the University of Notre Dame Law School. He will be followed in our first round of opening remarks by Professor Micah J. Schwartzman, who is the Edward F. Howery Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. And then we'll conclude our first round with Eric S. Jaffe of the Law Offices of Eric S. Jaffe right here in Washington, D.C., where he is an appellate litigator. Our second round will be a slightly different order, but we'll introduce that when we get to it. So for our first round on Hobby Lobby, the floor is yours, Professor Moreland.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you to my co-panelists for joining us on this exciting and important day for the Supreme Court. I'll just say a few words about the background to the contraceptive mandate and then some brief remarks about this morning's decision. The Affordable Care Act, which is the health care reform bill enacted in 2010, had as one of its provisions that employer-provided plans had to cover a range of preventive services without requiring copays on the part of the employees who are covered, and then delegated to the Department of Health and Human Services deciding about what the range of preventive services would be. The department then tasked the Institute of Medicine with coming up with a list of preventive services to be covered, and accepted the IOM's recommendation that among these covered services would include a number of contraceptives and IUD devices, including some that religious free exercise claimants argue have potential abortifacient properties. When the department promulgated this regulation, they did provide a relatively narrow exemption for a range of religious institutions, basically houses of worship, and then later on accommodated some religious nonprofits, universities, hospital systems, and the like, from this requirement. But there was no exemption or accommodation for for-profit businesses. And that brought us then to the threshold of today's decision in Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, which were two claimants who were for-profit businesses run in a closely held corporate manner, who had religious objections to providing the abortifacient drugs and the IUD devices as part of the employer-provided plans. And again, they had no exemption or accommodation from this requirement from the administration. So they filed a claim. The Hobby Lobby, an Oklahoma corporation, won in the 10th Circuit, and Conestoga Wood, a Pennsylvania corporation, lost in the 3rd Circuit. And those were the two cases that were consolidated and were decided today. Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion for five-justice majority, arguing that, at least as a threshold matter, that for-profit businesses do have claims that they can bring under the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And that was the premise of the claimant's argument here, that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was a statute enacted in 1993, in response to the Supreme Court's decision in Employment Division versus Smith in 1990, requires that when the federal government imposes a substantial burden on religious free exercise, that the government show that it has a compelling interest and has pursued the least restrictive means of accomplishing that interest. And so Justice Alito, in his majority opinion for the court today, argues that indeed these for-profit business owners do have the ability to bring these free exercise claims under RFRA. That is in many ways the sort of central issue between Justice Alito's majority for the court and Justice Ginsburg's dissent over that issue. Although the sort of all-out claim that for-profit corporations have no ability to bring these free exercise claims was not something that Justice Kagan and Breyer, in a separate part of their dissent, said they were not willing to reach that issue. The real problem with the government's imposition of this mandate, according to Justice Alito's majority opinion, was that the government failed to establish that it had pursued the least restrictive means. That is, it had failed to show that the way in which it imposed this mandate on claimants such as Conestoga Wood and Hobby Lobby was the least restrictive means of accomplishing the government's interest. Whether compelling or not, the majority opinion actually sort of says, we'll just assume for the sake of argument that this is a compelling government interest. The real problem with the government's case, though, was that they had failed to show that they had narrowly tailored the way in which they imposed this mandate on for-profit businesses such as Conestoga Wood and Hobby Lobby. And the proof of that was the fact that the government had accommodated nonprofit religious institutions by giving them an opt-out from this by requiring that their insurance carriers provide this benefit without the employer having to cover it. And as Justice Kennedy and others point out, as Justice Alito also points out, the government can provide this benefit itself. And that is another less restrictive means of imposing the mandate. So I think the decision really kind of came out the way a lot of us might have expected after the oral argument, that you had a five-justice majority holding that RFRA claims can be brought by closely held corporations such as Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, and that the real Achilles heel in the government's case here was the government's failure to establish that it had pursued the least restrictive means of accomplishing that. So that's a bit of background and a quick high-level summary of Justice Alito's majority and a little preview of some of the arguments made by Justice Ginsburg in her quite strong dissent. And with that, I will turn it over next to Rick Garnett.
Thanks, Michael. I appreciate that. Very helpful summary. I think I might try to supplement or amplify that just a little bit, not so much by focusing on the details of the lead up to the litigation, but maybe even taking things to a higher elevation if you want. So if you go back in time a little bit, like way back in time, I think it's fair to say that we've always been confronting this general question of how to deal with the fact that in a religiously diverse society like ours, that has a government like ours that does things, that regulates, there is going to be conflict. There's going to be tension. The only way to eliminate the tension between religious commitments on the one hand and government regulation and the government's idea of the common good on the other hand is if everybody agrees or if the government doesn't do anything. But of course, in our society, the government does a lot and there is disagreement. So the problem that RFRA addresses is one that is ineradicable. The existence of that problem should come as no surprise to us. We have a country where lots of people have different deeply held commitments, and we have a government that does a whole lot in pursuit of its understanding of the common good. So we have to think about how are we going to deal with these kinds of conflicts. And throughout our history, the Supreme Court has kind of waxed and waned and wandered in terms of how it was going to deal with those. But maybe a big watershed moment, as I think Michael suggested, was with the Employment Division versus Smith case 25 years ago or so. In that case, the Supreme Court told us that it was not the job of courts, it was not the job of unelected federal judges to second-guess the cost-benefit analysis or the balancing that legislatures do when they're deciding whether and how to accommodate religion. The court recognized, I think, that accommodating religion is important, that our commitment to religious liberty is deep, that religious minorities can be vulnerable. But I think what was driving the court's opinion in Smith was a sense that courts were not very well suited to second-guess the judgments that legislatures came to. We can argue the merits of that decision, but I think that's what it was. Well, whatever we think of the merits of that decision, it seems pretty clear that Congress thought it was wrong. And so, as you've heard, a couple years later, Congress nearly unanimously enacts the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And that's the act that's at issue in this case today. But one way to think about what RFRA did is to say, is to regard it as Congress's response to Smith, where Congress, in effect, is saying, we want the courts to second-guess our work. We want the courts to help us strike the appropriate balance between religious objections on the one hand and government policy and government compelling interests on the other hand. We want courts to make sure that we've taken due account of the burdens that even general laws can impose. One way to think about it would be Congress inviting the court into a shared project, right, of making sure that religious freedom is accommodated to the extent possible. It's not going to be possible to accommodate religious liberty claims all the time. It wouldn't be desirable to accommodate religious liberty claims all the time. But the policy of RFRA, I think, is that when religious liberty claims can be accommodated, they should be. And we haven't had a whole lot of decisions from the Supreme Court telling us how to think about RFRA, about how its terms should be applied, about how broadly or narrowly it should be construed. And for me, one takeaway of today's case, wholly and apart from the specifics having to do with the mandate and even having to do with Hobby Lobby's particular objection, is I think the majority's opinion talks about RFRA in, I think, a very broad and generous way. Right? The policy of RFRA is seen as a general one, inviting religious accommodations. The idea that RFRA should be construed narrowly as having to do only with a few subsets of cases, like the kind that the court's pre-Smith precedents had dealt with, that view is rejected. Justice Alito's explicit that the test that RFRA sets up, the balancing test that RFRA tells courts to apply, is a very demanding one. But again, what's interesting about this approach is because it's happening under a statute and not under the Constitution, what we have here isn't what some people might call judicial activism or the court kind of imposing a one-size-fits-all answer to tricky questions of cost-benefit analysis and so on. This is a dialogue. Right? Congress enacted a statute. The court's applying the statute. Congress remains free to respond. And I think this is an approach to the exemptions and accommodation problem that's a healthy one. Now, how RFRA will be applied in other cases going forward remains to be seen, but I think, and again, this is wholly apart from the contraceptive mandate debate, I think the court's instructions for the future to lower courts is think about RFRA broadly, take RFRA seriously, regard its policy as being one of generous accommodations. And I think that's a healthy development. There's more to be said, obviously, but with that, I think I'll pass it off to my friend, Professor Schwartzman.
Thanks, Rick. I think these summaries of the opinions have been very helpful. I thought I would maybe get further into the decision in Hobby Lobby and maybe my characterization of it will conflict some with what's been said already. So I read Hobby Lobby as also interpreting RFRA quite broadly, but going well beyond anything that the court has said in favor of religious free exercise in the past. So first thing I'd say is this case, I think, puts to rest any challenge to RFRA's constitutionality. I don't think there was a serious challenge available, but the court is clear in grounding RFRA's constitutionality and whatever statutory authority it had for the statute that's being challenged. And I think it does it as an aside, but I think it's an important note. I mean, in Ocentro, RFRA's constitutionality is assumed, and it might be here too, but it seems like the court goes further than that to stop any new challenges to RFRA's constitutionality. I think beyond that, the way that the majority reads RFRA goes not only beyond the existing First Amendment or free exercise doctrine under Smith, but goes beyond any of the doctrine that came before Smith. The way that Justice Alito reads the statute is broader than the court's pre-Smith jurisprudence, and he's quite clear about that, especially in rejecting application of some pre-Smith precedent to the challenge here. And I'm thinking mainly of United States against Lee, the case involving an Amish employer seeking an exemption from the Social Security Act. In responding to that earlier precedent, the court says, look, that's a First Amendment case. This is a RFRA case, and RFRA gives more protection than even the First Amendment did prior to the court's decision in Smith. And that's quite striking, I think. That argument wasn't strongly briefed. It was discussed at oral argument, but I think it wasn't the central focus of this case, and yet the court relies quite heavily on it. The second thing I'd say is that the court in this decision is I think blurring the line between churches and for-profit organizations. It's one argument that the court considered in some of its earlier jurisprudence is that churches deserve special kinds of protections. The decision in Hosanna-Tabor involving the ministerial exception seems to be based on this idea that religious organizations require special solicitude. After Hobby Lobby, it's not clear that there is a very strong distinction anymore between a church that is a nonprofit religious organization and a for-profit religious organization. And one question that we'll struggle with in the aftermath of Hobby Lobby is, what's the difference between a church and a company like Hobby Lobby? Are there any differences in the rights that those organizations are entitled to exercise? And maybe by introduction, the last thing I'll say about this is that Hobby Lobby is not a narrow decision in the sense that it only applies to abortifacients. I think it's quite clear that this decision applies to challenges to all forms of contraception. The accommodation that the court describes as least restrictive, and basically here I think the court is legislating an accommodation, that accommodation applies to all forms of contraception. So the cases that are waiting in the wings that challenge the contraception mandate, not just for the four abortifacients, but to all forms of contraception, I think are resolved effectively by this decision. And all the commentators who said, no, this case is really only about abortifacients, well, I think the majority is quite clear that wasn't the case, and I think actually most people expected that result if this RFRA claim was upheld and as it has been. You know, going forward, I think we're going to have a big discussion about what the limits are of this decision. The court describes itself as narrow. Kennedy says in his concurring opinion that the decision is narrow. The dissenters obviously read it much more broadly, and we're going to have litigation to sort that out. So I'll stop there. I should hand things off to Eric Jaffe.
Thanks. Well, you know, given that we've sort of talked briefly about the case, I'm going to cover a little bit of the bigger questions that Rick raised and then just a touch on the details of the opinion. What I found interesting about Rick's comments in particular were this notion of sort of this joint exercise between Congress and the courts of sort of balancing accommodation and regulatory power. And, you know, there are a couple, three different ways to look at that. One way is that this is Congress being cowardly in its unwillingness to enforce its own obligations vis-a-vis the Constitution. You know, rather than look at the laws it passes and ask itself, is this too much, and then take the heat for that if they decide it is too much, take the heat from the factions that want the law passed, they just pass the buck to the court. Now, this should come as no surprise, given that they do that in lots of instances. They pass all kinds of things that if you ask them privately, they think were unconstitutional. And even sometimes when you ask them publicly that they think is unconstitutional, and then figure the courts will take the heat for striking it down. A second way to look at it is that this is actually a useful tool for maintaining checks and balances in the balance of power. I could imagine that RFRA got pushed through by a relative minority of Congress that understood that they would not be successful in advancing their religious accommodation arguments on a piecemeal basis, but felt like if they did it on a wholesale basis, that their opponents would have a harder time objecting. Because there would be no immediate public policy to counterbalance it. And from that perspective, it's actually quite a nice little tool, much like, say, a filibuster or something like that, which stops Congress from running roughshod over what would otherwise be difficult constitutional questions and then, you know, just not doing it. This at least puts a check on them and basically enlists the court to help them with that check and balance function. That view of it is not quite so disparaging, I guess, in that the court there plays its balance of power function, and even though the buck is being somewhat passed, it's to help correct a problem in Congress between, you know, factions forming on wholesale or retail bases. The last way I'd like to look at it, and this may well be the right way to look at it, is that and maybe it's a mixture of the first two in some sense, is that this basically said, stop deferring to us on these kinds of questions. You know, the court, in its constitutional jurisprudence generally, and certainly in its religious jurisprudence in the past, and Smith being the greatest example of this, has been very deferential to Congress, and is often criticized by folks like me for being overly deferential to Congress on constitutional questions. This basically takes it out of the constitutional realm and says, we give you permission to just look at it straight rather than in this overly deferential paradigm and make a call. And in that way, it's sort of nice. And in some ways, it's the way I think it would be nice if the Constitution were construed generally to take away some of this deference to a modern Congress that gives no attention to the Constitution. And so that's sort of a third, somewhat combined way of looking at it that focuses more on sort of the role of courts and the sort of surrounding jurisprudence of deference. I like all three of those interpretations, and I suppose they could all three be true, but it just gives you a way to put it in perspective and how to look at it down the road, whether this is a plus or a minus that Congress has fully passed the buck to the courts on this, or at least largely passed the buck. Regarding the details of the opinion, there are just a couple quick comments. One is that, I thought that, you had five justices saying that this applies to for-profit corporations, that there's no meaningful distinction for religious exercise purposes between for-profit and non-profit. I think that was plainly the right answer. You had two justices, Kagan and Breyer, who wouldn't take a position on that, but that leads one to believe that they were at least skeptical of the attempted distinction the government was drawing. And then you just have the two of them, dissenters, saying no, religious nonprofits are different. And while I think religious nonprofits are indeed different for many purposes, not the least of which might be taxation, I do not think it makes any sense whatsoever to say that they are different for purposes of exercising their religion. Now, of course, a religious entity may have a much broader scope of exercise in what it does and how it does it, and that I think goes to this question of the ministerial exception that Professor Schwartzman mentioned, and a for-profit entity may have a smaller scope of how it chooses to advance or act within the confines of its religion. And so you may have differences in application, but I think in principle there should be no differences, in that I don't see a hard and fast or a necessary distinction between commercial activity and religious observance. I think the two can go together. There are lots of traditions that require them to go together, Judaism being the most obvious, and I'm sure lots of others as well. The last thing I'd point out is about the alternatives and the who pays and do the women lose something by not having their employer pay for this. And to me, it struck me that this had the flavor of a takings clause type of argument of who should bear the cost of this public good of making these types of contraceptives available free of cost. And the court at the end of the day answered, if you want to create this public good of giving out free contraception because you think that's a good idea, it's not clear that the people who should bear the greatest cost are those with religious objections. Just bear it yourself, bear it collectively in society, and then go right ahead and do it. And I think it's interesting to look at it that way, as a takings-esque kind of answer to a unique burden placed on particular individual employers. And that's all I have.
Terrific. I want to go back. This is Dean Roy, by the way. I want to go back for a moment, if we could, to Professors Moreland and Garnett and see if they have any response to what they heard later. I'm particularly interested in whether or not, in your opinions on whether this applies to all forms of contraception or just the four that were apparently explicitly at issue in this case. So, Professor Moreland?
I think that that probably made Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Woods' argument in this case stronger, but I think I think Mike is probably right that those who have sincere religious objections, such as the Catholic institutions that are involved in the litigation, now working it up through the district and appellate courts, that they will probably have the benefit of the same kind of arguments. And then the issue will be whether the accommodation that's been offered to them is sufficient for RFRA narrow tailoring or not. But I think Mike is right that the same arguments about burden would apply.
You agree, Professor Garnett?
I do, and I would also just add quickly, Professor Schwartzman was talking about the case of Lee, which the court dealt with a little bit, Justice Alito's opinion dealt with. as I read Justice Alito there, there was sort of two moves. One was to say, well, remember, Lee was a free exercise case, and this is a RFRA case. But then he also said, even if we were to analyze the problem presented in Lee under RFRA, that case would still be different because it turned on the difficulties of administering specialized exemptions to, you know, the general tax program. So it seemed to be running through the analysis there, an idea that people who raise religious objections to paying taxes are probably asking of the government more than it can provide. But this is different. This is, I guess, as Eric put it, more of a question of the government's decided to provide a benefit. How should it go about paying for it? So I thought that was kind of intriguing. And there's also a really interesting footnote in the opinion that deals with an issue that that Mike has written a lot about, which is, how do we think about the baseline question here? Is this a case where the government is taking something away from the employees in order to provide a benefit that is an accommodation to the employers? Or is this a case where the baseline should really be kind of before the benefit, if you will, and what the government's done is take resources from the employer and use those resources to fund the benefit for the employee? It's a lot of kind of fine hair splitting and so on, but I think that footnote is going to be one that people are going to talk about a lot.
Where does this all leave us with regard to publicly traded corporations or corporations that aren't controlled as these were apparently by a single family or a small group of folks? Anybody have strong thoughts on that?
I have a little bit of a thought on that. I think the answer is it leaves us to look back to state-level corporate law. I mean, corporations, like any other entity, have fixed procedures for determining what their decisions are, what their policies are, how they do and do not act, and what principles they act according to. And that's true of large public corporations like Exxon, no less than it is for these. And I think the court was exactly right that it's much less likely, though not impossible, that a large corporation would adopt a kind of "we will follow Christ's teachings in all of our dealings" kind of policy than a small corporation like this would. However, that then becomes a fight for the shareholders and the directors and whoever else state law says is in charge of these questions, as it should be, just as I think whether to divest from South Africa was a fight for the shareholders and the directors and whoever else state law said had a stake in that. So it's not inconceivable to me that some corporation could have that fight and a sort of a religious accommodation faction could succeed. I could particularly imagine corporations in certain parts of the country where a large chunk of their shareholders and potentially a very large chunk of their employees favor that position. But again, I think it shifts the fight into the corporate boardrooms and the shareholder meetings, and that's okay. Corporations act and think collectively as a collective representative of their stakeholders, and that's the right answer.
Can I add one point? This is Micah Schwartzman.
Please.
I'm not completely convinced that state law is going to be controlling in these religious disputes, and that's because there may be establishment clause constraints on when courts can adjudicate conflicts over religious questions that might emerge between shareholders. That's what we see in the church property dispute cases. And it might well be that similar kinds of rules would apply even to state corporate law. This will depend on factual situations, whether we do indeed ever have publicly traded companies that emerge with these kinds of disputes. I don't know if that will be the case or not. But if we do, I wouldn't be so quick to assume that it's all easily resolved under state corporate law. That might well not be the case. And this move by the court may open up future religion clause or First Amendment litigation in that context.
This is
Rick Garnett, but I could also, just following on Micah's point, it'll be interesting to see whether we see any moves in Congress to confine the reach of RFRA to a subcategory of for-profit businesses, right? To sort of statutorily rule out certain kinds of corporations that might well be unprincipled, but you could imagine politically there being some appeal to that position.
Well, and similarly, Eric, again, similarly, you might see a state law effort to constrain what for-profit corporations will be allowed to take as their purposes. I could see that happening, and then they're just removing, you know, limiting them the way the government argued they were already limited, but in fact limiting them to profit-seeking activities uninfluenced by sort of social or religious agenda. Now, that's going to be very difficult because we like them contributing to the Sierra Club and whoever else everybody's favorite pet charity is, but that would certainly remove this issue if there was such a constraint on them. I don't think we're going to see a lot of sort of religion clause fights in the interpretation of corporate law. It may be very difficult for a corporation to clearly state that it has a religious purpose and should act X, Y, and Z manner. But assuming that it does adopt such a policy through all the correct means, I don't see that individual shareholders or even large blocks of shareholders have any say in the matter at that point, any more than they'd have a say as to whether or not the corporation, you know, divested from South Africa if they lost the proxy fight. I don't see that as a religious problem at all. I see that strictly as a agency question, right? Were all the trappings and requirements for agency behavior fulfilled? If they were, great. If they weren't, great.
I've been alerted to the fact that our notice for this call was a little late getting out. If you're just joining our call, we're speaking with four experts today. We're discussing first among them the Hobby Lobby case, which was decided today in the court. We're about to turn to the McCullen versus Coakley case and get opening remarks from each of our experts on that case. And then we're going to be turning to the audience for questions on either or both cases. If nobody else has anything further on Hobby Lobby at this point, we are free to return to that later. Let's turn now to McCullen versus Coakley. And for some background on the case, we're going to hear first from Eric Jaffe. He'll be followed by Professor Garnett, who will be followed by Professor Moreland. And then we'll conclude those remarks with Professor Schwartzman. So, Eric Jaffe, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Dean. So in McCullen v. Coakley, the court was addressing a challenge to a Massachusetts law that restricted certain activities within a relatively broad swath of space in front of or adjacent to the entrance or the driveway of an abortion clinics, basically. It's defined in a particular way, but it boils down to abortion clinics. What was interesting about the case, I think, is twofold. One, it was a very large area that that the Massachusetts law prevented people from basically congregating in. In some instances, reaching across the street, and hence had a significant effect on the way people could approach and express their views about abortion, particularly to people seeking an abortion. The particular case was a woman and some others who sought abortion counseling and basically saying, oh, honey, I have an alternative for you. Let me tell you about it. So the court, in reviewing this, first decides that this is not a content-based restriction. It doesn't apply to what you say, but simply where you can stand and where you can be vis-a-vis an abortion clinic. And the court, in this instance, it was Chief Justice Roberts, joined by the four more liberal justices who rendered the majority opinion, at least, decided that this was a content-neutral rule because it was not justified by reference to what the particular speech was, but was instead being justified by general access concerns, access to the clinic, and basically traffic and safety concerns, so that not to crowd the sidewalk and create obstructions in general. So the majority ultimately says, we think it's content-neutral, we analyze it under intermediate scrutiny, but all that being said, and we assume your interests are compelling, but all that being said, you haven't shown that less restrictive alternatives are inadequate. There are laws against actually obstructing a clinic. There are traffic laws against obstructing traffic. There are laws against harassing or intimidating people, and all of those laws are sufficient, and while they might not be as easily enforceable as a blanket rule just kicking people out from in front of a clinic entirely, that there's still a less restrictive alternative vis-a-vis speech, and consequently the Massachusetts law has to be struck down. An incredibly narrow ruling, in large part providing blueprints for how narrower laws might be applied. And I think that's why you see Roberts pulling on the four more liberal justices who in some instances might be more skeptical of this because it basically gives them the blueprint and gives abortion clinics the blueprint and states the blueprint on how to do this in a way that is more likely to survive. Four justices dissented. Joined, concurred in the judgment, but expressed views that the non-content-based holding of the majority opinion was incorrect, that this was in fact content-based and should have been struck down on strict scrutiny. The main opinion on that was by Justice Scalia, joined by Kennedy and Thomas. Alito files another concurring opinion concurring in the judgment, making a similar point. And what is interesting about that clash, I think, is that it's sort of different views of what's going on here. So I don't think it's a stretch to say that what was happening was that the state did not want women seeking abortions to be intimidated by folks saying, oh, abortion's terrible, abortion's murder, don't have an abortion. And that it really was primarily about the reaction that these women would have and the deterrence effect of that reaction. But they can't say that because that makes it content-based. So they instead come up with these other sort of pseudo-concerns of it's blocking access in general, not because you don't like what they're saying, but just because they're in your way, and it's blocking traffic. And by shifting over to those neutral-sounding interests, what ended up happening is the state turns out to have had very little evidence that those interests were really at stake and had very little evidence that they had considered alternatives to meet those interests. And what the dissent, I think, effectively points out, though I don't think that was their purpose, was that these interests are somewhat of a straw man or straw men, and we should really look at what's going on here, which is they've singled out abortion clinics. They don't like anti-abortion speech because it scares off the women. So that's just an interesting thing to think about in there, about this coming out the way it did because the interests advanced were somewhat constrained by existing constitutional precedent and thus had to be a little bit fake. And because they were fake, they didn't stand up very well. And I will turn it over, I believe it's to Rick at this point.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. I don't have much to add to that, just a few observations. So one thing I should say by way of disclosure, I guess, is that I participated in a amicus brief that argued that that this was the correct result, but that Hill versus Colorado had been wrongly decided and should be overturned, and I think it was wrongly decided and should have been overturned. And there actually was, as we described in the brief, a fairly bipartisan consensus among a lot of free speech experts that Hill was just really hard to justify, that this idea that regulations of speech around abortion clinics are somehow content neutral seemed hard to square, not only with precedent, but certainly with sort of civil libertarian commitments of the kind that we see running through a lot of our free speech discourse. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people where if you tell them, look, a ban on burning your draft card is content neutral, they wouldn't buy it for a second. We know why you ban burning draft cards, government man. Or some might say, look, we know why the government tries to limit sleeping in the park. It's not just because of a content neutral reason. It's because they want to target a certain side of the debate about homelessness. What seems like something like that was and is going on here, but as Eric describes, the court frames this in such a way that the regulation is regarded as content neutral, and therefore it's on a different track in terms of analysis. Now, even on that track, it loses, and I think it's good news for the freedom of speech that it loses 9-0, but I do think this was a missed opportunity to correct what I regard anyway as the mistake in Hill versus Colorado. A second general thing that might just be worth pointing out and maybe thinking a little about is the argument between Justice Scalia on the one hand and Justice Roberts on the other about what to do with this case, that is Hill. It echoes some of the other ones we've seen on the Roberts Court, where you'll have cases where there's a precedent that's being debated, whose validity is called into question. It might be Flast versus Cohen with respect to standing, right? Or we saw just a little while ago in that Michigan affirmative action case that there was a real disagreement about how to think about some older cases having to do with political participation rights and so on. What divides these justices, it seems, is a willingness to identify cases that are problematic as having been wrongly decided and to overrule them. We saw that in the public employee union case that was decided today as well. Abood is identified as a problematic case, but not overruled. And this is simply one of the things that I think scholars and commentators will talk and think about a lot in the years to come when it comes to the Roberts Court, is not so much not only the disagreements that the court had about outcomes, but the what appears to be this different orientation toward precedents that are regarded as problematic. One side seems to have an instinct that if the case is wrong, perhaps it ought to be overruled. Some other justices seem to have an instinct that you can maybe minimize the damage of, or cabin the implications of, or perhaps just rework a precedent without actually overruling it. And so again, something to look for, something to talk about going forward. And I guess I hand it off now to Professor Moreland.
Yes, thanks, Rick. Just a couple of thoughts to add, echoing some of what's been said already. One is that McCullen complicates in an interesting way what I think is a kind of oversimple way of thinking about these free speech cases, which is that if something's a content-based regulation, the government's in trouble. If it's content-neutral, the government's okay. Because at least for free speech libertarians or conservatives, the fact that the majority opinion for the court, or the opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, argues that the content-neutral regulation of time, place, and manner still has teeth, does give, I think, some reason to believe that the kind of government's okay answer of Clark or Ward versus Rockin's racism has to be complicated, so that the traditional sort of qualifications that the regulation has to be justified without reference to content or narrowly tailored and have ample alternative channels, the government didn't satisfy here, and that might set a template then for other challenges to putatively content-neutral regulation. And while it's, of course, this McCullen is a constitutional free speech case and Hobby Lobby is a statutory free exercise case, there is, I'll try to make an effort here to put something about the two together, and that is that in an interesting way, in both cases, the government lost because of its failure to, at least in part, make an argument about how it had pursued its regulation by the least restrictive means, which just as a lawyering strategy, point means that the government has to do its homework better in some of these cases where it's imposing on religion or free speech. As was made clear in oral argument, in McCullen, for example, there were all kinds of ways that the government, Massachusetts, could have accomplished its objectives without imposing this 35-foot buffer zone around the clinic. So given that the record for the most part showed that the problems were isolated to the clinic in Boston, there are injunctive relief is an available option. Of course, there's a federal access to clinic statute that the government can bring criminal prosecutions under. There are also state disturbance of the peace and trespass prosecutions and the like, and that if the government hasn't shown that it has exhausted those possibilities or hasn't even pursued those possibilities, then the government loses because it has failed, at least with respect to that test of the free speech analysis. So I think in an interesting way, just again, for especially the practitioners listening in, there's a lesson here about how you sort of what basket you put your eggs in has a lot of import then both for the challengers and for the government in these cases. And the government, by making arguments that I think in the end the courts rejected as implausible with regard to narrow tailoring or least restrictive means, meant that the government lost in both. And with that, I'll turn it over to Micah.
Thanks, Mike. I think that last point was a good one, which is that these cases are about the details, what counts as in Hobby Lobby a least restrictive means, and in the speech context, a similar kind of inquiry is at work. I guess I would push back a little bit on the argument anyway that there's no content neutrality in this case. I think there's ample precedent under the court's free speech doctrine for suggesting that this law, at least on its face, is content neutral. And there's some question about what it takes to show that it's not. I mean, in some ways, what you have in Justice Alito and Justice Scalia's opinions is a purpose inquiry looking at what the exemptions from this particular law, which had provisions for allowing clinic employees to move through the buffer zone that was created, what kind of message, if any, was the law trying to send, or what kinds of messages was it trying to curtail? What the majority of the court is saying is there was a perfectly reasonable explanation for the structure of this law, and that was justified by content-neutral purposes, that is, protecting access to the clinics and protecting the safety of the employees and patients who want to enter it. And I think to get beyond the text of the statute and the government's purported interest, you have to look at the underlying purposes and to impute to the legislature some illicit purpose. And that seems to be in some tension with other aspects of Justice Scalia, Justice Alito's jurisprudence regarding purpose inquiries. In the media, people have pointed to other types of buffer zones and asked why those aren't subject to similar criticism. Of course, the court has a much larger buffer zone that extends around the building, and when the Supreme Court justices travel, they also do so with security that includes a buffer. How come those types of zones aren't equally questionable under the type of least restrictive means analysis that you end up seeing in this case, even under the majority opinion? Similarly, in the case involving picketing at funerals, Snyder versus Phelps, Justice Alito seems to have more sympathy for those who are protected from disruptive speech than those in the clinic case at issue here. Again, maybe there are ways of reconciling his opinions, but at least it seems like there's some open questions there. And I think I'll stop there.
Very good. I do want to hear from Eric Jaffe and maybe Rick Garnett if you want to respond to something one of the later speakers has said. Eric Jaffe.
Sure. I think this tension just pointed out between, how do you determine the purpose of a law? I have a lot of sympathy for that point. The one thing I'll say is that it sort of goes back to this question of deference to the legislature that I sort of talked about on the Hobby Lobby case. We have this jurisprudence of just taking the legislature at its word. If they say we wanted, pink stop signs because we think pink is pretty and makes people calm, we just believe them, notwithstanding mounds of evidence to the contrary. And maybe we have to, just as a matter of judicial functioning. But here, I think, the notion that it was a perfectly reasonable explanation that they were just trying to stop congestion and traffic, I think is belied by the fact that they had no evidence that it was a problem, and they didn't tailor their solution even remotely to that. Very often in First Amendment cases, we find the overbreath or underbreath or lack of tailoring to be evidence that your stated interest is not either not your actual interest or is not really being advanced very much. But we typically take it for a statement that it's a false statement of interest, given that you wrote a law that doesn't seem related to that interest. And I think there's a little bit of that going on here, not as bad as in some cases, admittedly. But we might need to develop a jurisprudence that stops, that falls somewhere between what Scalia sometimes claims he wants to do, which is don't look behind the veil, and having the courts just look everywhere and do whatever they want willy-nilly. There seems to need to be some kind of way of weeding out straw men interests and straw men claims, even by legislatures.
Can I respond just briefly? I don't think the court, this is Micah, I don't think the court says that the interests are straw men here. They do say that this isn't, that the buffer isn't narrowly tailored to achieve it. But I think one of the reasons they don't go further to overturn the earlier decision in Hill is that they recognize that there are, in fact, serious safety and access concerns at many clinics across the country. And I don't think they want to be confronted with future litigation where they've pared back whatever safety mechanisms states have put into effect to find out only that, in fact, those interests have come to fruition in the worst possible ways. So, I think, the majority here is trying to negotiate a middle ground to protect speech interests, but also to recognize the important interests that the state does, in fact, have in these, in surrounding these clinics.
This is Rick. Yeah, I like Eric. I think there's a lot to this skepticism about, looking too closely behind legislation to try to guess what its purpose is, or certainly what the legislative intent might have been. But at the same time, I do think it's pretty common in free speech law to ask whether or not a law has the purpose of suppressing speech from a certain viewpoint or speech on a certain subject. And, you know, in Justice Scalia's opinion, he's got a number of moves that don't just have to do with trying to guess what was in the head of the legislatures. He infers, for example, from the fact that this bubble is dramatically under-inclusive with respect to its stated goal, and that it applies only outside of abortion clinics where a certain kind of speech is very likely to happen, that the law kind of objectively has as a purpose the goal of reaching abortion-related speech. Another thing that's just doctrinally interesting here, I think, is even as the Chief Justice Roberts' opinion does not overrule Hill or limit it, doesn't discuss it that much at all, it does say some things that I think require us to think very differently about Hill. So for the Chief, it's essential to the conclusion that this rule is content neutral, that it's not about the offense that the women entering the clinics might feel. It's not about their reactions to the anti-abortion speech or to the sidewalk counseling or what have you. It has to be justified entirely with respect to these things like access and traffic. And I think in Hill, there was a little more of a sense that protecting women entering these clinics from the kind of emotional disturbance or from the upset or the offense from dealing with that kind of speech was still cognizable as content neutral. And I think that's not true here.
Any comments from any of our other speakers before we turn to our audience?
Well, just to get into the weeds just for 30 seconds on the issue of legislative intent, I mean, I do think that a lot of that turns on what you make of the exemption for employees of the clinic acting in the course of their employment as exempt from the buffer zone. I mean, I think if you think that's about people shoveling the snow or the escorts helping the women come in and out of the clinic, then it looks content neutral. I think that Justice Scalia and Justice Alito make a good point, though, that is likely not what was contemplated, and instead that it was indeed to protect a certain kind of speech that was going on by the employees and not from those who were opposed to abortion. But again, that's a detail, but I think it makes makes all the difference then in how you parse that out.
I guess I would say, this is Micah, I would say just very quickly, if that kind of analysis, very close scrutiny to the implications, exemptions from a law were applied in a funeral case, or for that matter, in the Establishment Clause context in Town of Greece, I think we would see different outcomes potentially. It's a very close scrutiny of the purposes behind a statute, and I think it sits uncomfortably next to some of Justice Scalia, Justice Alito's approach to other types of discrimination cases.
Let's check in with our audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. For those of you who joined us late, this is a 90-minute Teleforum conference call. Our notice, unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, went out a bit late, so we're holding this call until 2:30 Eastern time, so we still got plenty of time left for questions. Before we move to the audience, let me make a brief commercial announcement. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, our Teleforum conference call will be discussing the other case decided by the court today. That's Harris versus Quinn on the unionization of personal care providers. And then on Wednesday, so that's tomorrow at 2 p.m., on Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, Professor Philip Hamburger will discuss his provocatively titled new book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful? And we'll have commentary by attorney Adam White. That's Wednesday at 3 p.m. Today, of course, we're talking about Hobby Lobby and Coakley. Let's go to our first audience member question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I had an organization, the Constitution Society, which is also known as a Constitutionalist Church. We profess the religion of constitutional originalism, and sustained by the precedent that humanism is a religion, we have religious objections to employer mandates of any kind. So, can any of you make a case that the statute applies only to employers that do not support the Constitution.
Who wants to respond?
I could make the case that it's not a sincerely held religious belief. It may be a sincerely held belief, but I think characterizing it as religious, since it doesn't relate to the existence or non-existence of a deity, but the applicability as a political matter of a document, makes it highly suspect that this is subject to this part of the First Amendment, as opposed to the free speech clause, obviously. But that's as far as I'd be willing to go.
I think even if, this is Micah. I think even if it were religious, this kind of challenge would be assimilated to the challenge in the United States against Lee, despite what Justice Alito says about RFRA being more protective. I think you'd see Justice Kennedy split off and say, no, a challenge to the entire statute would be more like a challenge to paying a Social Security tax or paying taxes generally. The employer mandate, even an oral argument, the chief says this is like a tax. And it's one thing to have a selective objection to a particular provision. It's a whole other matter to have a religious objection to the entire statute. I would be very surprised, even after Hobby Lobby, if any kind of objection along those lines, religious or not, were successful.
This is Rick Garnett. I think Mike is clearly right there, and I think the court, in Justice Alito's opinion, kind of takes several opportunities to tell us that the focus of the analysis really is on a context like this, where you have a clearly, sincerely held religious belief that is triggering an objection to a specific provision for which an accommodation is, at least the majority thinks, possible.
Professor Moreland, you want to chime in here?
No, I think it's been covered.
Yep. All right, let's take another call. Hi, J.D. Pirro, Federalist Society. I apologize if this question's already been asked. I called in late. But I'm curious as to your interpretation of Justice Alito's comment and which occurred again in the Kennedy concurrence, that there's a less restrictive way of providing for contraceptive coverage that was not adopted in this particular case by HHS. I was wondering how you think that might affect subsequent litigation regarding religious organizations and their requirement to provide contraceptive coverage.
Well, this is Mike Moreland. So, of course, it clearly means that in Hobby Lobby that there is this less restrictive means that the government has already extended, and so the proof is in the pudding there. I think that the question now for Little Sisters of the Poor and other claimants who are religious objectors will be whether the certification to the third-party administrator that is part of the accommodation out, whether there is something, some less restrictive alternative to that. So I wouldn't want to read too much now into the mere fact that right now that in Hobby Lobby they just hold that out as an alternative. I think that we'll have to await the answer once the religious claimants once the religious nonprofit claimants get their case teed up.
Yeah, this is Rick. I think that's right. There's a place where I think it's Justice Alito says that this the existing accommodation that's in place for some of the nonprofits is less restrictive with respect to the objection that the plaintiffs here, that is Hobby Lobby and so on, have raised to providing the insurance coverage. I think that does leave open the question whether if the objection is to that nonprofit accommodation mechanism, well, then the mere existence of the nonprofit accommodation mechanism doesn't show that it's the least restrictive means.
Professor Schwartz or Eric Jaffe?
I think the court leaves open the question of what action Little Sisters have to take in order to claim an exemption, whether they have to certify to HHS or to a third-party administrator seems open in the text of Justice Alito's opinion, but I think they're going to have to make some claim for an exemption, and I think that this opinion forecloses the option that any kind of exemption would lead to employees not obtaining contraception. I don't actually think that was Little Sister's aim in this litigation, but to the extent that anyone thought that employees wouldn't receive the benefit of access to contraception, I mean, clearly this opinion is premised on the idea that the government will be able to provide it in all of these contexts. And I think that's an important, actually, result from Hobby Lobby, which is that that this is a compromise from which everyone leaves, I think, with what they want, which is, that is, I mean, on the employer side, the Greens and other religious employers don't have to provide these contraceptives or payment for them, but the employees will receive them. And so there are no third-party burdens, or at least ostensibly there ought to be no third-party burdens given the way that the majority sketches out the least restrictive means here. That's an important result, and I think it's going to hold in the nonprofit context as well.
Eric Jaffe, anything on this point?
Sorry, just a brief notion that I think it will be interesting whether or not having to just certify is deemed a violation of religious exercise and a burden on their religion. I think, given the way the current opinion is written, they're going to have a little time quibbling with whether the action violates, it's contrary to the religious tenets of the Little Sisters, because they sort of foreclosed that quite a bit in the opinion. On the other hand, there's something to be said for it may not well be a substantial burden, a la Ginsburg's dissent. I mean, I understand the substantiality of having to fund something, but about having to tell someone that you're not funding it because you have an objection, having to inform them of your objection, it strikes me that that part of the question is going to be a little harder, of how exactly does the informational portion burden you if you don't actually have to provide it.
For those of you who dialed in late, we're taking questions now on both cases, Hobby Lobby and Coakley. We've had opening remarks from all of our experts on both cases, so any question is fine at this point. We've got three callers pending. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to another caller.
Hey, it's Stephen Casey with Texas Center for Defensive Life. A real brief question. It seems that one of the challenges, and I think it was really brought up by the first caller, is that the court is struggling, I think, with defining what sincere religious belief is, because you have a lot of politicians who pass this legislation who obviously would say they are from a religious tradition and background that doesn't support contraception, but yet they will pass legislation that does that. And the argument on the other side from the Greens and everyone else is that this religious belief is part of an integrated whole that they've got to express not just on their day of worship, but throughout the week. And so I see the court's struggle with actually just defining what is religious and what is not, and where to draw that line on sincerity. And I think that right now I think the first caller has, to a certain degree, a justifiable objection in saying, look, religion has become really whatever you want it to be, as long as it's sincere. And I think the, let you get your opinions on where the court should really come down on that, and what type of analysis they should use to decide what is religion, as religion versus what is religion as just a sincerely held belief that's not necessarily religious. What's that dividing line?
Who wants to take a shot at that? Any responses?
Well, I mean, this is Eric. I would normally defer to the professors who teach this stuff. Rick, talk to you. But I guess the answer is, for me, that this is an inevitable problem under the First Amendment. It has constantly been a problem of distinguishing sort of belief or principles in general from religious belief. I believe we should not be in Iraq. Is that a religious belief? Well, I suppose if I believe that because it's desecrating Iraq, it's a holy site, maybe. But it's not a problem that's new. It's not a problem that we haven't dealt with before. And if the answer is the line is incredibly fuzzy, and at some point you're going by feel, and I know it when I see it, that's okay. We all like perfection and mathematical precision, but you can't have it in the real world, and that's okay. And, if you're talking about God and your obligation to a higher power, or even your obligation to act morally, we're more inclined to think that that's a religious belief. If you're talking about your obligation to, a court's obligation in how it operates government, we're less likely to think it. Not that the two can't overlap. It's just that a thumb is going to be on the scale suggesting that if I think we should follow the Constitution, that's a political belief, and if I think we should follow the Torah, that's a religious belief. That's just not that hard for most people in most cases.
Do one of our professors want to weigh in?
Yeah, I think that's right. This is Mike Moreland. I mean, the government has to, as I was indicating earlier in connection with Coakley, I mean, the government always has to make choices about where it wants to open up its battles. And I think here, the owners of Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, there's pretty clearly a sincerely held belief. But that doesn't mean that the government couldn't always argue about that and that courts can't assess that. I mean, there's a difference, I think, between the sincerity of a belief and the centrality of a belief. And the more outlandish the claims and the more difficult the line drawing, I think then the government would start pushing back on the sincerity. It's just that Hobby Lobby wasn't that kind of case.
And this is Rick Garnett. Maybe I'll say it because Professor Schwartzman's being modest, but it's true both that this problem is inescapable and that we've been doing it for a long time. It's also true that there's a lively debate about whether the distinction that we make in our law between religious beliefs and practices on the one hand and just sort of moral or conscientious ones on the other, whether that's justifiable. I mean, one might think that distinction shouldn't be followed, but for courts, since they're usually dealing with legal texts that use that category of religion, they have no choice but to try to come up with rough and ready ways for distinguishing, you know, one person's love of a particular food or a restaurant or a sports team from a religion. But they usually actually do manage to muddle through pretty well, I think.
This is Micah. I think Rick is right that, you know, given the statutory text, courts don't have a choice about trying to understand the term religious and the idea of a sincere religious belief. I don't know if it was Mike or Eric who said that this is not a new problem. Courts have had to do this for a long time. I think that's also right. So I don't see Hobby Lobby as changing much there. But what is different about Hobby Lobby is in adopting a very broad understanding of what counts as sincere religious belief following the court's prior decision in Thomas against Review Board, it also adopts an extremely deferential approach to what counts as a substantial burden. And there, I think, is some innovation, because the court's jurisprudence prior to Employment Division against Smith, the Peyote case, put some checks on what counts as a substantial burden. And it's, I think, not entirely clear how much scrutiny the court is going to give to claims that there aren't substantial burdens in the future. Hobby Lobby, this decision, and the majority anyway, suggests that the government is going to have to do a lot of work to show that there aren't substantial burdens, and that seems to shift the burden from the challenger, which is where the statute places the burden of showing a substantial burden, more onto the government to show that, in fact, there isn't one. I also would say, in addition to that, that this litigation was somewhat rushed on this question. The arguments weren't fully fleshed out on whether there's a substantial burden under this statute, and Justice Alito, in the majority opinion, is relying on some speculation about the empirical facts, as were the parties, about how much Hobby Lobby would have to pay if it decided to put its employees into the exchanges. Those kinds of questions, I think, will be litigated more forcefully at the outset of future challenges. After Hobby Lobby, it'll be clear that the government needs to raise these kinds of objections if it wants to pursue them.
Let's take another question. Go ahead, caller. All right, let's move on to our next caller.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. This is a wonderful discussion. My question is, given the state of recent federal court decisions on LGBT rights with respect to the Windsor decision and, for example, the case coming out of, I believe it was New Mexico, requiring a private business owner to either photograph a same-sex wedding or bake a cake for a same-sex wedding, what impact do you think that today's decision in Hobby Lobby will have on those specific causes of action or future possible lawsuits?
Any response to that?
Well, this is Rick Garnett. The caller is certainly right that there have been some widely reported cases where claimants have objected to providing services and have seemed to run into conflict with state anti-discrimination laws. As more and more states adopt same-sex marriage, or as more and more courts do, I suspect there'll be some more of those. You know, on the one hand, Hobby Lobby speaks to these matters because it does say that it's possible for a for-profit business to exercise religion and to, in a sense, cross the threshold of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. At the same time, I think the court takes some care to signal its view that anti-discrimination laws are presumptively justified by a compelling state interest, and that they're often thought to be the least restrictive means of achieving that interest. So I wouldn't foresee Hobby Lobby resulting in any kind of large number of cases where people are objecting either to anti-discrimination laws generally, or to their application in the specific same-sex marriage context.
This is Micah Schwartzman. I hope Rick is right, but I'm actually not entirely sure. What the court says in Hobby Lobby is that anti-discrimination laws with respect to race are not in question. Anti-discrimination laws with respect to other categories, I don't know that we know exactly what will happen here. I mean, the court basically erases the distinction between religious nonprofits and religious for-profits. And with respect to religious nonprofits, those types of organizations have a lot of latitude in who they can discriminate against. Think about the decision in Amos in which an LDS organization fires a janitor because he doesn't meet their religious criteria, or the Boy Scouts in the court's decision in Dale, where they're able to discriminate against a Boy Scout leader who is gay. I don't know how Hobby Lobby is going to apply in those circumstances, but I think we can be confident that there will be challenges, and that question will be litigated.
We've got four questions pending. We're trying to get to all of them before we adjourn. Let's take another caller.
Hi, this is Drew Clark at the Deseret News in Salt Lake City. I think I want to build on that last question, and apologies if you discussed this earlier. Could you just elaborate a little bit more on the issue of racial discrimination versus gender or same-sex discrimination, and then kind of take it just a step beyond that, because the New Mexico case is not on its face, as I understand it, about discrimination about a same-sex couple, but about reluctance to participate in a same-sex commitment ceremony or marriage, which again kind of seems to go right back into the deeply held religious beliefs of the owners of that store. So could you just elaborate a little bit further on this and differentiate out not only race from sex or sexual orientation, but from practices that impinge upon religious beliefs of business owners?
Who wants to go first here? Perhaps one of our professors will volunteer.
Well, this is Mike Moreland. I think it's, well, this didn't help much, but I think it's unclear because, as Mike and others pointed out, in Hobby Lobby, the government gets to accomplish its interest by providing these free drugs, free contraceptives, and the religious objectors get their exemption under RFRA. So that, I think the court's majority opinion is clear that's an important consideration here that may not be applicable in the anti-discrimination context, where you have places of public accommodation that the government can't just create exemptions to and still accomplish its interest. So I think we'll see. I mean, Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent, of course, not surprisingly, makes a point of this, right? That the majority opinion, in her view, anyway, leaves open a lot of room for doubt and interpretation about what kinds of RFRA claims will be successful and what kind will not. But I think it is clear that Justice Alito doesn't want to go there yet.
Do you agree, Professor Schwartzman? Do you want to weigh in?
I mean, I think that's basically right. We just don't know the answer, and it may be that the majority, that there's not consensus about how far RFRA will insulate religiously owned corporations from other types of provisions, various kinds of anti-discrimination provisions. It might be that Justice Alito, for example, and Justice Kennedy don't see eye to eye on the outcomes in those cases, or maybe they do, but I just don't think the court says enough to tell us the answer, and that means that we're likely to get litigation over that question. It invites challenges to clarify the extent or the scope, the reach of the court's analysis. You know, it might be also that there are going to be factual differences in these kinds of cases where certain types of public accommodations are available generally in the market. Maybe the majority would say the government doesn't have a compelling interest or least restrictive means in ensuring access to those kinds of goods. You can think about the pharmacy context where there are conscience clauses that allow some pharmacists exemptions from laws that require them to provide forms of contraception. I mean, where someone else can take their place, maybe there is not a burden on those individuals. But and so these kinds of questions might be highly fact sensitive, and at least in its more general framework, that's exactly what the court seems to suggest. RFRA requires case by case analysis, very fact sensitive kinds of inquiries. Whether we'll get general rules for anti-discrimination laws that go beyond race, that category of cases may well be special, I think is something we'll just have to see.
If you've got a question for any of our experts on either case, the Hobby Lobby case or the Coakley case, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick, Washington, D.C. I think I'm being redundant, but going to carry this aspect of the conversation a little bit further. Nurses, and there are multiple nurses, so there's the ability to accommodate. Nurse refuses to participate in an abortion, let's say, because of sincerely held religious beliefs. Or a court clerk, there being other court clerks, refuses to administer the wedding ceremony to same-sex couple. Or the closely held company that refuses to, I think this was asked earlier, be the wedding caterer or the photographer for a same-sex wedding. Gather there seems to be an emerging consensus amongst all of you that as long as it isn't race and as long as there is an accommodation, there is a way that the wedding will still go forward, the cake, the photographs will still be taken, the abortion will still be done, that the courts may very well now hang their hats on Hobby Lobby and say we're going to give first place to the sincerely held religious beliefs because other governmental interests, other constitutional, statutory, anti-discrimination interests are not being trampled upon. And then I guess the second, I don't know if that was a question, but the second part of my question is why, other than it's in the Constitution, it always gets strict scrutiny, as it well should. Is that the reason that race is singled out is probably verboten, but maybe everything else is fair game?
So this is Rick Garnett. One quick thing is I think a lot of these cases, the Elaine photography type case and others like it, it's just worth remembering that at least for the near future, those are going to be litigated under state law, right? A lot of states have their own RFRA, other states have their own religious freedom exemptions doctrines, and some states when they've moved to adopt same-sex marriage have included some kind of exemption type provisions in them. I'm part of a group of some scholars who've proposed some language that could be used for what we think of as relatively narrow targeted exemptions for certain contexts. So whether Hobby Lobby kind of controls or immediately dictates how all these cases are going to come out, I'm not so sure. It'll certainly be part of the conversation. With respect to the is race different question, I guess I feel pretty confident that when you're doing the RFRA type balancing and you ask on the one hand, does the government have a compelling interest, that courts are going to say that the government does have such an interest in combating not only racial discrimination, but also discrimination against against other groups. And the question will be whether or not, as we saw in Hobby Lobby, I guess, whether or not there are less restrictive means, and whether or not there are, as Professor Schwartzman pointed out in another context, whether there are serious burdens being imposed on third parties by virtue of the accommodation.
Any other comment on this point? All right, let's go to another caller.
Hi, thank you, Matthew Crist, attorney in Virginia. I have a little bit of a larger foundational question. It seems like the putting a lot of square boxes into round holes by attempting to figure out, you know, sincere religious beliefs, et cetera. And at least for Hobby Lobby, can anybody comment on whether there's any hints in the Hobby Lobby opinion about the court maybe moving back towards viewing these kind of contractual arrangements, what should be a contractual arrangement, reviewing them as property rights issues between the two contracting parties, as opposed to mandates, and also the government mandating that people use their property in a certain way, namely providing health insurance and you know, prophylactics for people. Is there any, I know over the last 80 years, you know, SCOTUS has pretty much been into a box that they can't get out of. They can't view these types of things in property rights issue, you know, lights. But is there any hint, does anybody have any, you know, feelings about this moving back towards property rights, maybe over the next decade or a couple decades?
Yeah, I have a feeling. This is Eric. I have a feeling about it. It's not going to happen. That's my feeling. I mean, you know, they barely protect actual property rights. They've long since sort of put contractual and employment-related issues into a box called economic regulation that we don't care about. They're not going to suddenly, A, discover that they actually like property again and are going to protect it in a meaningful way, and then, B, suddenly take all this economic stuff that they've been let run rampant for, you know, since the New Deal, and put it in that box. So we have a box that's not going to exist, and a subject matter that's not going to get put in the box if it didn't exist. That's my gut, and nothing in this made me think any differently. The reason this case seems to protect an employer's ability to run its business is because it's about religion. It's running business according to your religious tenets, which I think is good and fine and right. I agree with you on the big question that I think property rights should get just as much deference, but they don't.
Eric Jeffy, your characterization of the court and property rights, does it hold true for each and every justice, or some better than others?
Let me step back. No, there are some justices, I suppose Thomas most notably, that might be willing to unwind a century's worth of precedent, the bad precedent at that, and go back in that direction. But I think even folks like Scalia, and certainly not Roberts, are even remotely interested in going there. And you look at Scalia's reaction to things like the anti-delegation challenges, and he just backhands these things. He may, deep down inside, think they have a nice principled foundation, but he's not going there. He's not unwinding the modern-day federal government and taking away all government regulation in the name of Lochner. So while I think an individual might occasionally trumpet that tune, I don't think the court as a body is going to go there, and I think you would be hard-pressed to even get the more sympathetic justices to go there.
Go ahead, Mike.
I was just going to say,
I mean, since we're almost out of our time, that it is worth just for a moment pointing out that, I mean, although the media culture wants us to kind of make these opinions into sort of catastrophic changes in the shape of our law, that in the end this was a statutory case about how the RFRA requirements applied to the government's mandate here. And I think in a pretty straightforward way, Justice Alito's opinion says they didn't, and for the following reasons. And so I just think that, you know, it's important that people not kind of overinterpret. And this is something that both the right and the left are sometimes susceptible to, but I think especially on this one, I think people on the left will and already have, and to some degree, overreact about what this means. And it's important not to overstate that. But Mike might disagree.
Well, on
in some surprising ways, maybe I agree more on this latter point, that the cases can be overread. I think that's right. What's left open by Hobby Lobby, and some of our previous questions have gone to that point, is I think that's important, and left and right are going to disagree to some extent about that. But on the property issue question, whether this opens a broader challenge to the state's regulatory authority, you know, one of the interesting points about Hobby Lobby is that it's premised on the idea that the government has regulatory authority to cover contraception for all of the female, and for that matter, male employees who are now going to lose that coverage because the owners of Hobby Lobby will get their exemption. In other words, the silver lining for progressives in the Hobby Lobby decision is you get socialized coverage for contraception. I mean, this in some ways is extending the state's regulatory authority, not curtailing it. And maybe that will be an aspect of Hobby Lobby that's further explored, that the least restrictive means will be an expansion of the government's regulatory power here. Of course, reactions to that will be very different. I mean, the left will see that as a silver lining, the right maybe not so much.
Yeah, I agree that this will, I imagine, encourage the government to start providing these things directly rather than indirectly. I'm not sure I would characterize that as an expansion of their authority. It may expand the exercise of that authority, but I think that's water under the bridge. We've long since agreed that the government can tax you and take that money and give goods and services to whoever it wants. You know, I mean, I don't think this is anything new in that sense. It may just be a blessing on this particular exercise of go ahead and do that. At least it's better than what you were doing. In some ways, I view it as akin to all the disclosure requirements in campaign finance, where I think those are unconstitutional too, but all of a sudden, in order to get out of the restrictions, we said, well, disclosure is a less restrictive alternative, and all of a sudden disclosure is now constitutional, notwithstanding cases dealing with anonymity and anonymous speech. So maybe it is a silver lining for the left in that sense.
We've got 2 minutes left. Let's see if we can squeeze in this final question, if our caller can be very succinct.
Good afternoon. Matthew Morley, Pennsylvania attorney living in Maryland. I apologize if your analysis has already covered this question, but is it at all possible that the plaintiffs in today's case, Conestoga Woods and Hobby Lobby, would end up here again in a few years or however many if the government were to impose on them the so-called accommodation regime that uses for religious nonprofits, which I understand as check a box on a form, I have an objection, and it'll be between the insured and the insurers, leaving you out of it. And also, if I may, is it at all possible that the religious nonprofits will still win their battle against the so-called accommodation because of their claim that it involves coercion, that we have to get the government after Catholic self-insurers and so forth when we check that box? Thank you.
Who wants to respond here?
Well, this is Rick Garnett. I guess on the second question, I do think that the merits of the religious nonprofits cases are still alive and well. I don't read the Alito opinion as having said that the current accommodation is the answer to everybody's objection, just that it's a less restrictive way that the government could have gotten the coverage to Hobby Lobby's employees. Now, whether we'll see Conestoga and Hobby Lobby and other entities challenging whatever the administration's policy or response turns out to be, I'm just not sure. I'm no expert, but I suspect that if the government just moves to the alternative of having the government pay for it, that there would be no lawsuit filed, and if there were, it would be a loser.
I'm afraid we're going to have to let that be our final word. We are out of time for our call today. I do want to thank Professors Rick Garnett, Mike Moreland, and Micah Schwartzman, and Eric Jaffe as well, for joining us here today and lending us their expertise. To the audience, thank you for joining for your questions as well, and a reminder to our audience that our next Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. when we'll be discussing Harris versus Quinn, the other case decided by the Supreme Court today. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/ multimedia.